You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, August 4th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Gillian C. York, author of Silicon Values, The Future of Free Speech Under Surveillance Capitalism. Meanwhile, Kansas's referendum to save abortion rights in the state have Democrats thinking, maybe we can do it in other states. I'd love it, and it would help their own asses electorally as well, because of the turnout thing.
Abortion is more popular than Democrats. Sorry.
In the Senate, Sinema is back in the driver's seat, and she's not saying if she will or won't sink Manchin and Schumer's slim climate bill over a tax hike on the wealthy and corporations, and a very minimal one at that. The Senate has overwhelmingly approved NATO expansion for Finland and Sweden to join, with only Josh Hawley voting no. NATO is expected to make this official by the end of this year. The fallout from Nancy Pelosi's Taiwan visit continues. After her departure, China launched missiles close to Taiwan in a display of force. More on her absolute arrogance in a bit. Representative Jackie Walorski, Republican Congresswoman for Indiana's 2nd, along with two campaign staffers, died in a car accident yesterday. Ivanka and Don Jr. have sat for depositions in the New York AG's civil investigation into the Trump Organization. Trump Sr. penciled in to do the same later this month. We'll see if he shows. Alex Jones's Sandy Hook defamation case has caught the attention of the Jan 6 committee after Jones's lawyers allegedly accidentally sent a digital copy of his phone to the victim's attorney. Now congressional investigators want to be CC'd on that email. And lastly, Brittany Griner has been found guilty and sentenced to 9 years in a Russian prison for cannabis cartridges. But hopefully that means, now that they have their conviction, that the U.S. prisoner swap for her is a little bit closer. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is an Majority Report Thursday, one of our branded weekdays. Don't use our copyright or we will come after you with the fullest extent of the law. We are we're intellectual property hawks here, didn't you know?
The property mongers.
Just kidding. So I mentioned this in headlines, but Nancy Pelosi, her visit to Taiwan has been, I think, not covered critically enough. So I want to do a deep dive into that to start off the show. Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan and just left either yesterday or I believe yesterday. And no, this is not a diplomatic visit. Reports indicate that Biden and Blinken were unhappy with her decision, but that they let her basically go ahead with it anyway. And she's the most senior official to visit Taiwan in decades. It's notable to say that there's a power imbalance here, right? Because the Taiwanese government officials are not necessarily in a position to turn down a U.S. Politician of her stature, given the United States' commitment to defending Taiwan militarily if China does choose to escalate. But the U.S. has not really contested China's sovereignty publicly over Taiwan since the 1970s, so it's a very delicate balance here. And that is independent of our views on Taiwan's self-determination, because I think Taiwan should be able to be independent if it so chooses. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the United States as a third party and its posture potentially escalating conflict between China and the United States. And this also comes after the bill just passed the Senate, the CHIPS bill, which is explicitly written in a way that escalates rhetorically at the very least, and also economically, a rivalry between the United States and China. And I just think history should tell us that we should be wary of these kinds of escalations based on the Cold War and the fallout from that. And it's a complex dance, but Nancy Pelosi threw a wrench in that, presumably against the wishes of the Biden administration, against what most diplomats and people in international relations and government and people who analyze this from the outside, against all of those recommendations. And here she is in Taiwan responding to the outcry about her visit, which I think should have been a bit more specific, frankly.
But I think it's important to note that members of Congress, several of them have made trips just earlier this year. Five senators, bipartisan, came, again, including the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, Mr. Menendez, came. Not too much of a fuss was made. Individual senators have made trips or plan to make trips. And I just hope that it's really clear that while China has stood in the way of Taiwan participating and going to certain meetings, that they understand that they will not stand in the way of people coming to Taiwan. That's a show of friendship, of support, but also a source of learning about how we can work together better in collaboration. So, I think that they made a big fuss because I'm speaker, I guess. I don't know if that was a reason or an excuse, because they didn't say anything when the men came.
More female conflict escalators, right? I mean, I cannot believe that she took that tack. But naturally, I guess that's something she falls back on. Can we pull up this thread from this Harvard professor who's done actual work in this space? He spoke about why her visit to Taiwan was such a terrible idea. Do we have this? Here's William H. Overholt thread. Pelosi accomplished much in Taiwan. She stimulated cyber attacks, got thousands of businesses banned from exporting to China, shut down the important cross-strait communications tool Weibo, elicited mainland military exercises, and stimulated an imminent temporary blockade. Could scroll down. Long-run consequences are more important. She raised tensions at a time when tension is already excessive. She damaged Xi Jinping when he is ensuring his third term and is under attack for being weak on Taiwan. This forces him to take especially strong ongoing measures. She irritated allies who want support against China but fear U.S. provocation of China. From Australia to Japan, they resented not being consulted. And by the way, this is at the same time that the U.S. is doing its annual military exercise off the coast of China with other Asian countries. She made the U.S. look weak and divided by ignoring the advice of the most informed parts of the executive branch. Biden made that worse by insisting he couldn't influence her, and Blinken made it worse by appearing supportive after the fait accompli. She raised the baseline for future military signaling, which to show seriousness will now have to start with exercises completely surrounding Taiwan and likely blockading it. The added tensions will imperil vital efforts to get China to agree to guardrails that would limit the risks of accidents, misunderstanding, and unwanted escalation. What she didn't do was strengthen Taiwan or U.S. support for Taiwan in any way. Trump, Pompeo, and Biden already pushed that support to a point that jeopardized the 1979 understanding, which is the foundation of Taiwan's enjoyment of peace, prosperity, and democracy. Her visit was not just a rerun of Newt Gingrich's visit a generation earlier, which occurred during an entirely different relationship between the two countries. It was a political stunt that took a dangerous situation and made it more dangerous. I mean, I thought that that was very well put, frankly. The reality of the situation is that, as I said kind of at the start of the show, the stakes for Nancy Pelosi are very different from the stakes of the people in Taiwan. As I mentioned, I think her visit was concealed up until the very last moment, partly because they want to take China by surprise to a degree, but it also, there were memes reportedly circulating about her visit that no one even knew who she was, and yet she's going there as a political stunt in order to kind of put a capstone on her decades of China hawkery, or anti-China hawkery, I should say, in the House as her career comes to a close soon, hopefully. That seems to be the consensus about her motivation. But we don't face the risk of military threat or violence based on this kind of visit and provocation. Taiwan does. Taiwan does. And so for her to conflate and say that just because past government officials have done this, she's third in line to the White House. She's Speaker of the House. There's an understanding.
I have to say on that, like, this is not, to downplay the significance of it is to basically play on people's ignorance of how it's being greeted in Taiwan, which is a major, like you said, third in line coming to visit them, which doesn't happen.
Yeah, of course. And so,
because of the historical reason, like, both Taiwan and China think they're China, like, for historical reasons, right? Like, this isn't some sort of, like, this is a very complicated historical and political problem. And I think Pelosi, and I also just want to note, some people are saying that we can't really know for sure if this was against the wishes of Biden and Blinken. Well, not that, just take their word for it until they classify, like, communiques and stuff like that. But it really, it's what it seems to be is like sending a message to the world post-Ukraine that we're the tough guys still. And I don't, that's not a message that I want Pelosi sending.
And for people downplaying military exercises because of this and a show of force by China as they were shooting live ammunition and missiles across in the waters outside of Taiwan, think of how you would feel if you were in Taiwan. I think there's really an arrogance surrounding this discussion, frankly. We don't know how that feels. And no one seemed to think this visit by Pelosi was a good idea, and I really wish that the coverage about it treated the decision with the respective disgust that it deserves, frankly.
I mean, I think the problem is we have, a very jingoistic mood that likes the appearance of toughness, and this is going to work for a lot of people. I think that's what, at least that's what Pelosi thinks. Like, we're going to look tough again, and I think there's a lot of people who want that, unfortunately.
I was reading some response in the New York Times, and they said, well, Pelosi just really undercut the Republicans' position on China in the midterms.
Oh, and I guarantee you that is on Pelosi's desk on whatever plane she's flying across from, and they're drinking wine over it.
Yep. Well, with that said, we have a message from our sponsors here before we head in to speak with Jillian C. York. Profiling, surveillance, data harvesting, there are a lot, lots of things not to like about tech giants. But what can you actually do about it when you rely on so many of your products? I mean, this is kind of apt for our interview today. We are in a technological world, we're on Twitter, we're on Netflix, streaming services, we're on, you know, whatever, social media, Truth Social, we're re-truthing. Not exactly.
I gotta go check all my truth alerts, which are exclusively Donald Trump tweets.
Except follow, yes, at Matt Leck on Truth Social. For less than $7 per month, you can fight back against big tech by using ExpressVPN. Big tech companies make all their money by tracking your activity and then selling your personal data, but ExpressVPN helps you anonymize much of your online presence by hiding your IP address, which is helpful if you want to... Sam's used this example. He doesn't want to splurge for the MLB package, so he'll watch Red Sox games using this, allegedly.
Yeah, if you've ever had, like, games blacked out on NBA League Pass or something like that, you should fight against that.
It's so annoying.
Yeah, resist.
With ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN makes it much more difficult for them to exploit your data for their own profits. And the best part is how easy it is to use the ExpressVPN app. Just tap one button on your phone or computer to turn it on, and that's all it takes to keep people out of your business. If you don't like big tech tracking you and selling your personal data for profit, it is time to fight back. Visit ExpressVPN.com/majority right now to get 3 months off ExpressVPN for free. It's a good deal. That's expressvpn.com/majority, expressvpn.com/majority. All right, we got to take... We are back, and we are joined by Jillian C. York, author of Silicon Values, The Future of Free Speech Under Surveillance Capitalism. Jillian, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. You wrote about this, I think, at the start of your book about Silicon Valley's conception of freedom being a libertarian one. And I still think sometimes people have difficulty grasping that concept, maybe just because of like a liberal aesthetic or just something as shallow as an association. Guys, I'm not on camera. An association with San Francisco. But in your decades of research into Silicon Valley and big tech, like what did you find that underpins that assertion about its libertarian conception of freedom?
Sure. I mean, I think a lot of the early early internet thinkers were libertarians, self-statedly so. But really what I've seen is that a lot of these companies pay a lot of lip service to freedom of expression, to human rights. I mean, we've seen this with Meta or Facebook's latest human rights report, which is pretty shallow. But ultimately, these companies are doing what's best for their bottom line and not what's best for their users or for rights.
Right. And you mentioned Meta and Facebook there. I think that was a large focus of your book. Why would you say that Facebook is kind of the worst offender in terms of the structure of that company? And what do you find about it to be so problematic?
Yes. I mean, I think it's fair to say that all of the major tech platforms, social media platforms, have problems with their policies and practice. But Facebook or Meta really is one of the worst offenders. And part of it is the structure of the board and the company, the fact that Zuckerberg himself, you know, has a majority majority share in the company. But also just the fact that they really, they put a strong focus in the United States and on issues there, but they really marginalize the rest of the world and the rest of their users, even though those users make up the majority. And that's really what gets me with Facebook, is that they're not even really trying to fix the myriad problems that advocates have brought to them for the past decade or so.
And what does that look like when it's tilting the scales in favor of wealthier countries, kind of tracing over the lines of colonialism and exploitation and just printing it onto their algorithm to a degree? How does that manifest itself in reality?
Sure. I mean, there's so many examples, and marginalized people everywhere, including in the US, are often, silenced by these platforms. But to give one clear, concrete example, we've seen a lot of exceptionalism when it comes to the way that Ukrainians are being treated on these platforms. They're given a lot more leeway, including violent and extremist groups in Ukraine that are fighting back against Russia. They're given a lot more leeway to share violent content and praise of even, neo-Nazi organizations. Whereas Syrians, on the other side of that, another population that's been in conflict for more than, for a decade now, they're often, absolutely silenced by these platforms. Human rights documentation is removed by the platform. So even things that could be used in, say, war crimes tribunals. And so that just kind of demonstrates the imbalance and the sort of disproportionate leeway given to certain groups. And, often, again, like you said, along colonialist lines.
And is that, would you trace that more to power imbalances, or is it really just, well, it's probably one and the same, but there is, of course, racism involved, but that's obscured, I guess, because people think it's tech, it's an algorithm. There's no way for it to have a racist infrastructure or one that, exacerbates already problematic and existing power dynamics. What's your response to that?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I think it is a little bit of everything. But really, I think what we have to keep in mind is that there's humans behind the algorithms. Humans are the ones making the policies, deciding that, and this has been explicit with Meta's policies, that Ukraine is given exceptions to their hate speech policy. It's humans who are building the algorithms, who are baking in bias into the ways in which these algorithms say, for example, decide what is or is not hate speech and what should or should not be taken down. So to use a fairly innocuous example, the word, I hope it's okay to say this, the word dyke, which is a word that is a slur but is reclaimed by queer communities, that's a word that algorithms often remove, even when it's being used positively or self-referentially. And so you can see how that would play out along other controversial terms. And that's, that's something that's programmed by people who either lack understanding of or deprecate the secondary meaning of a term.
And is it possible that, well, I'll ask this a little bit more straightforwardly. Are there any other major tech companies that are doing it better? Like, is TikTok doing it better? Is Twitter doing it better? Twitter seems and I don't know anything, but just from my usage, it seems to be the least problematic in that way. But I even hesitate to say that because, of course, it has its own massive problems as well.
Yeah, I mean, all of these companies have problems. I would say that Twitter, Twitter's been embroiled in some controversy over the past few months, and I'm not very impressed with their CEO. But at the same time, I do know some folks on their policy team, and I see the effort that they've put into getting geopolitics right, at least. They do get a lot of other things wrong, so I don't want to give them too much credit. If I were to point to a company that I think gets more things right than most, I would say Reddit, actually. And of course, they've certainly had controversies over things like, in the past, over child sexual abuse imagery, as well as more recently over the Donald. But they've put in place, rather innovative methods such as, quarantining a certain community so that it can still exist, there's expression there, but new people can't join. So it spread, it limits the ability for those communities to go viral. They also have individuals volunteer to moderate their own subreddits, which gives people, you know, sort of a sense of empowerment over the community that they're a part of. And I think that's really important. I'll also say Reddit gets higher ratings than all of the other companies when it comes to transparency.
That's interesting. So Silicon Valley, I feel like, has, and the, I think a lot of the libertarians and right wingers who are now using it as an opportunity to feel aggrieved, have conflated First Amendment violations with censorship on these platforms. And you argue that censorship should, there's, and I don't want to misrepresent your argument, but I believe you argue that censorship is good in some instances on some of these platforms. Can you talk about that false equivalency and what it upholds and why your position is what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so the First Amendment protects us from state interference. So companies, legally speaking, can do pretty much whatever they want when it comes to curating their own platforms. Now, my argument is really that censorship is a value neutral term. It's not a legal term. It's not synonymous with the First Amendment. And so the way that I see it is that there's censorship that we agree with and censorship that we don't agree with. And of course, we, you know, varies by community, by country, by person. And so, for example, I think it's fair to say that we, the majority of us, agree that child sexual abuse imagery absolutely should be censored. And that's okay. We should just be honest about what we're doing there. I think when it comes to terrorist, extremist content, that's actually a more, for me, that's much more up for discussion because there is some value for society to be able to see into a violent conflict. If we, you know, if we just let YouTube erase all of that imagery, then we're not necessarily going to know what's really happening on the ground in Syria, in Ukraine, in Yemen. And so that's an area where I would say that it's censorship and censorship that I don't always necessarily agree with. And so I guess what I'm saying with companies is that while I'm not in favor of censorship per se, I think that there are some things that they should limit for the greater good. And I think that we should be looking towards international human rights frameworks to determine what those things are.
Yeah, because as you say, we already draw a line. It's kind of similar to a gun control argument that we make domestically here in the United States, right? Which is, we already limit bazookas and we already limit certain kinds of weaponry. It's just where we decide to draw the line. And I feel like reactionary right wingers, they like to naturalize existing law or existing terms of service, right? In order to say anything that crosses that line or evolves from there is censorship or it's unconstitutional. When in reality, it's more just, it's not remaining stagnant. It's evolving to changing dynamics.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I won't get too much into my views on the Constitution here, but I think that, you know, when it comes down to it, those were decisions made by a certain group of men at a certain period in time. And while there's validity behind the ideas, I do think that some of these concepts need updating. Now, I am actually a First Amendment maximalist, I would say, but I've also lived in Germany for 8 years and abroad for at least a quarter of my life at this point. And so I can see other sides of that, you know, of the coin. And in Germany, for example, I understand why the government has made the choices that it has to limit certain things such as Holocaust denial. I think in the society at the time that was necessary. Do I think that that's something that they may need to review down the line? Probably. We shouldn't have rules that last in place forever.
Right. But it serves that purpose. Because stripping out the context in terms of free speech and censorship, that it's actually dishonest. And it also, I think, helps feed some of the worst figures and ideas and impulses, both here in the U.S. and internationally. And I would guess that the algorithms do nothing but aid and abet those kinds of movements.
Absolutely. You know, I really think that one of the biggest mistakes we've made as a society is turning over these decisions to algorithms. And it's, of course, not just speech decisions. It's also self-driving cars and image recognition and all of these other areas of life. But I think what we're going to see is that the machines aren't really as intelligent as these tech executives have promised that they are. And the mistakes that we see in content moderation, we're going to see in other areas of life as well.
So as you mentioned, you've lived abroad, and I want to get into your time living in Morocco, which you talk about a bit. But just in terms of these social media companies being international corporations. We talked about how they have double standards for different countries, but they also have to deal with law domestically in each different country and respond to that in terms of how their users are going to access their app or their website. What were some of the problems that you found that companies like Meta or Twitter encounter when trying to have its technology fit into different laws on a country-by-country basis?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, if we roughly divide the world up into authoritarian and democratic states, and obviously that's a spectrum, I think, then we can see that when these companies are faced with, demands from authoritarian or autocratic states, those demands are often over the top. Things like, no criticizing the king, no criticizing the royal family, or even the state. And so that sort of thing is often in the early days, these companies refuse that sort of demand. We saw this early on with YouTube, and I believe it was Thailand. I hope I'm getting that right. There's a lot of stories back there. But over time, democratic countries also began to make demands. I think France was one of the early ones with demanding that Yahoo auctions took down Holocaust memorabilia, or sorry, World War II, Nazi memorabilia. That's what I'm trying to say here. And over time, we've seen, for example, Germany, where I live, enact regulation that forces companies to take down hate speech within a certain brief period of time. I don't know what the current number is, but when the regulation first came out, I think they were looking at, a week or 24 hours. And so that sort of law, while maybe well-meaning, is often then copied by other countries. And then we see it, sort of morph and turn into this beast. And we've seen countries like India, Turkey, Mauritius, a dozen more, I think. It's kind of called the Brussels effect, right? Now I'm just mixing up terms. But we're kind of seeing these laws that are created in Europe then be replicated elsewhere throughout the world, and often in really damaging ways. And so, I think that companies are in a tricky position, but I also think that it's up to democratic states to create internet regulations that are not going to be used in that way. Because what we are seeing is kind of a new fragmentation of the internet, what, a lot of people have been concerned about for a very long time.
You cited, I believe, an example of Myanmar and Facebook's, I think some people are aware of this example, but about the way that the genocide was against Rohingya Muslims was treated by the Facebook algorithm and the powers that be there. Can you talk about that story a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So in that case, what we saw was that public figures, including members of Myanmar's military, including well-known comics and other, monks. So a number of different public figures in Myanmar were using Facebook to incite violence, to incite genocide, essentially, against the Rohingya. And I'm not sure that it's even fair to blame the algorithms in this case, because Facebook staff were made aware of this and still failed to act. They only acted after an investigative report. I can't recall if it was Reuters or AP, but a large-scale investigative report several years into the ongoing genocide. And that was what prompted Facebook to finally take action. Part of the thing here was actually not the algorithms, but the fact that they only had, I think, something like 4 people on staff who could moderate in the Burmese language. And we see that sort of disparity all over the world with these companies. Facebook is often the worst, but Twitter is also under-resourced in a number of different geographies. So that's a real problem. In addition to the algorithms, not necessarily knowing the terms or being programmed, being programmed with the correct terms and the correct definitions of terms, we also see a lack of human moderators to do this job, which is a very, very difficult and harrowing job, as many of my colleagues have done research into.
And it's just so unprecedented because, again, we're still having conversations about free speech as a dynamic between a person or group and a government. And there's this third party now that has untold power, and it also is a third party that exists. It crosses country lines, but it also exists in its own right within those countries. And so, do you think that the the relationship between these three parties is not adequately reckoned with when we're talking about what free speech is, because now it's, you know, a government and a multinational publicly traded tech corporation that's also in the mix with an individual slash group.
Yeah, you know, I think we've gotten better as a society about talking about this. I think the media has gotten better about it. But I remember even just 6-7 years ago when I was giving talks about this, people would come up to me after and say, oh, but it's a company, like it can do what it wants. They don't have a military behind them. So, you know, their decisions don't really matter. And I think that they do matter. I mean, on the one hand, you know, we saw yesterday in the, I hate to bring it up, but the Alex Jones trial, where he was booted off a lot of these platforms and still made even more money than he was making before. So in some ways, this whole, you know, the phrasing of deplatforming works, something that I see all the time on Twitter. Does it really, like, is it actually effective? Maybe we heard less from him, but if he's still, you know, bringing in a profit, I'm not really sure that it's that effective. On the other hand, you know, deplatforming does work, or the silencing of people does work when those are people with marginalized identities, people who don't necessarily have another means of communication. And I'm thinking more about people in countries where the government is also a censor, where the government is also oppressive. So Egypt is a very good example of this, where people don't necessarily have other channels than these American platforms through which to share things that are going on the ground, because all of those other platforms are either captured by the state or have been shut down. And so I think we do have to think really carefully about what this means. And I think we have to view it through a global and not a US-centric lens, because so often these conversations, these slogans that get thrown around like deplatforming works, don't take into account the real needs and rights of people throughout the world.
So you mentioned Egypt there. I guess that's a good way to talk about your work and your study of the Arab Spring and that time period and big tech's role in that. You lived in Morocco. Talk a bit about your experience there and what your observations were.
Sure. So when I lived in Morocco, I was in my very early 20s. I went there to teach English after having studied abroad there for a brief period. And when I arrived, I think the very first night, I went to an internet cafe to send some emails home and went to log into my LiveJournal. So I'm dating myself here, and found that LiveJournal.com was blocked in Morocco. It took a couple of days of figuring out what that meant. From the US, I'd never encountered internet censorship back then. This is about 2005 or six. I found a couple things. One, that the government was in fact blocking it. And two, that the reason for that was that people were using the platform to document some of the human rights violations happening in the Western Sahara, which is occupied by Morocco. And so that became a really interesting thing for me to look into and study. And through my, you know, just curiosity about that, my blogging, I started looking into the free speech situation in the country, and the plight of journalists who at the time were really being persecuted by the government, for a number of different reasons, which are documented in the book. But through that, got involved in some networks throughout the Middle East and North Africa region, and really got to know a number of people who would then, just a couple years later, go on to be key players in the uprisings, including Alaa Fattah, a really good friend of mine who is still in prison on hunger strike in Egypt right now. We've been pressuring governments to, you know, to get him out. He's a British citizen. Sorry, I had to throw that in there. But yeah, so that work became really important to me. And through that time period, I was just really involved in, you know, connecting people to media, documenting things that were going on, talking to press about the situation of the internet. You know, as you know, the internet was shut down by the Egyptian government with the help of a multinational tech company. And so I think that time period was just really instrumental in kind of, you know, setting the stage for everything that was to come after that.
What happened in that time period when the Egyptian government was able to do such a thing? I mean, what were those conversations like with tech companies? What was the relationship? And what can we learn from it now?
Yeah, so the tech companies really, you know, I think most of the ISPs did follow the government's orders. I'm failing to recall some of the details, but my recollection of this is that the Egyptian internet was not centralized. And so it required the government sending an order to the tech companies to shut down their services. And all but one of them complied. The one that did not was a local company that had only about 4% of the market share. So those that did comply were mostly multinationals, and they basically said, we're just following orders. And so that sparked a number of conversations that led to things like, you know, channels between advocacy organizations and telecommunications companies, I think that are led by the organization Access Now. There have been a number of different groups put together to, you know, to work with tech companies to make sure that they are auditing their practices on privacy and free expression, et cetera. But I think that that just following orders is still pretty common practice for a lot of tech companies from the US, as well as from other places, although I think we're seeing a bit more progress in Europe. But still, you know, the US tech companies are the big ones. And so if they get a demand from, you know, a government such as Turkey, Israel, I'm thinking countries that, you know, do have large market share and are in some ways ostensibly democratic, although perhaps on the decline, they're going to follow those orders. And so, you know, while they may refuse a request from a smaller autocratic nation, they're not going to say no to a country where they've got, you know, a strong economic stake, and therein lies the problem.
Yeah. And you mentioned an audit of these, multinational, or not multinational, but of these tech companies. We've never done an audit of a Meta algorithm or a Facebook algorithm or the way that that content is disseminated. I mean, what would that look like? I think we've talked a lot on this program about antitrust as a good avenue to pursue breaking up some of these tech companies and their stranglehold on things. But I'd be very curious if, you know, there was some sort of congressional subpoena and we had to, got to look under the hood if, you know, Democrats were serious about anything.
Yeah, I mean, there's audits being done of the policies and some of the content moderation practices. So one group that does that is the Global Network Initiative. And I believe that there are others now forming. Ranking Digital Rights is another group that looks at this stuff. But the fact is, nobody really is able to look under the hood at the algorithms. They're, you know, they're seen as or declared to be proprietary. And so because of that, they're protected. And that means that we don't have the ability to look into them. And so we're basically relying on these companies to self-audit. I can't proclaim to be an expert on, you know, how Congress could get around that or do this. That's where the lawyers would come in. And I don't want to misstate anything here. But I think that, you know, we are reaching a point where we do need to know, you know, what is being programmed into the algorithms. This you know, goes in a couple of different directions. One is the algorithms that are being used to moderate speech. And we've seen the problems of that. But I think another one is the algorithms that are used to curate our feeds, to show us the things that we see on a daily basis, too. There's a whole bunch of issues there as well. From the ads that were being shown to the fact that, you know, it don't, for me, I go on YouTube to watch like a makeup tutorial and it's 6 or 7 videos until I'm getting right-wing extremism sometimes. That is very curious. And I think that we should be looking into that.
So you talked a bit about, or I shouldn't say a bit, you in your book about censorship of sexuality on some of these apps and websites, and that was it was something I haven't heard discussed much outside of, you know, the hashtag free the nipple thing that happened like 5 years ago or whatever. But I haven't really thought about it too much since. Why were you so impassioned by this particular topic, and you know, what do you suggest for how some of these tech companies can respond?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so I've always been really interested in kind of free body culture, freie Körper culture in Germany, and as well as, you know, parts of where I grew up in the US. And so the idea that the human body is something inherently sexual has always really bothered me. And so when the Free the Nipple campaign came about, which was almost a decade ago now, maybe 8 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Like 2014, I think. I was really happy to see that people were taking on this notion. And it was only a couple years after that I started hearing from and listening to sex workers who, you know, or people who are even sex work adjacent. So this is a spectrum between things that are not legal in the US, but things that are, but also things that are completely legal and not even really sex work, such as pole dancing. Those folks are constantly being silenced by these platforms and not just having that content taken down. So it's not always just explicit content being removed. Sometimes they're losing their entire accounts. Sometimes they're even losing their PayPal or other payment accounts because of the work that they do. So I spoke with somebody in the book who wasn't even able to pay for groceries because that person was doing was posting videos related to sex work on Instagram. So these companies seem to be talking to each other. We don't necessarily have that evidence, but nevertheless, that's really where my interest comes from. Is that you know, for me, it's particularly when it's legal, but even when it's not, it's a profession, and we wouldn't be okay with censoring a florist. Why are we okay with censoring somebody who chooses to sell sex? And I think it's just really troubling. And so that's why I documented that. I actually dedicated two chapters to it. One is about more about sex. The other one's more about the human body. But I think that they go hand in hand. And it just goes to show, you know, how I think the U.S. is really out of step with a lot of other countries on this matter.
Well, we are puritanical, but they're also, I mean, what's your reaction to the rise of something like OnlyFans? I know it's a little cloistered on the internet, but maybe that's some sort of progress in that way. I hesitate to even say that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, you know, I think that it's troubling in a society when that's people's only option. And so I think we should say that outright, that people should have options for employment and options for, you know, making money. But there are people who choose that profession, and I think that's absolutely fine. I also think OnlyFans is a really interesting case because I think it was last summer. Time is a confusing entity these days. But last summer, OnlyFans tried to shut down sex work on its platform, or shut down at least certain types of explicit things like porn. And they got so much backlash, and it was really interesting to see. They actually, you know, they dialed it back. They changed their minds. And we've seen other interesting things like the, I think it was the museums in Vienna choosing to put their artwork on OnlyFans, just to protest against the fact that some of their nude art gets censored on Facebook. So I think it is progress in some ways, at least within the society in which we live.
Yeah. But at the same time, there could be ways for there to be homes for nudity on just standard social media platforms where you could control or turn things off. Say, you know, if you have a 10-year-old, I think that's fine to say, okay, turn off the nudity thing on Instagram. That was, I think, something that you suggested as well. But the retaliatory part of it, if you break terms of service, we're going to shut down your PayPal account. Mm-hmm. I know that you can't prove that coordination, but that does seem to be a troubling kind of indicator, because these social media companies are so massive and they are the gateway to financial security for so many people, and there's just no recourse, and terms of service is acting as law in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. I'd say, you know, on the one hand, you said something, and I know I'm missing it. So I'll start with this, and then maybe I'll find my way back to it. So I'm talking with somebody now who is based in Europe and who's done porn, basically, and pretty popular stuff. And that person has been kicked off of Instagram, even though they were not posting sexual content, because of their job, we presume. They've also lost access to other platforms. And again, they live in a country where their work is perfectly legal. And I find that really troubling. You know, I think the other thing here is that these platforms could make adjustments to the way in which they filter content. So we know that they use facial recognition to detect certain things, or sorry, not just facial recognition, image recognition to detect certain things. So they're able to detect, say, violent content, first person shooter videos, breasts, whatever it is. So why not use that? Why not put that tool in the hands of users and have users be able to filter out really whatever they want, whether it's nudity? You can say, I don't want me or my children to see nudity, and that's fine. That's a person's decision to make. But why do we have to ban it for everyone based on the needs or demands of the lowest common denominator? And I don't know who that is, frankly. Over the years, I've surmised that it's that it's the United States and puritanical culture, that it's the demands of Saudi Arabia. But ultimately, I kind of think that it's Mark Zuckerberg. I think that these decisions are being made by people in a company who impose their values on the rest of us, their Silicon values, so to speak.
Yeah, wonderful. Sorry. Plug there. Yeah, no, it was perfect. I mean, I actually, now you remind me that I did want to talk about Zuck, right? Like, are we all just living in his sexual frustrations from when he was 20 years old, and now it's just that's what's created society?
I mean, he did start Facebook as kind of a hot or not style platform, which to me is something that an incel would do. Now, he's obviously not one. He's married. His wife seems lovely. But I do feel like he has imposed a certain young man's ideal on this, and that he really hasn't, you know, grown out of it. This despite the fact that he's a married man with children. Again, it may not just be him. There are other people within the company who may also be imposing their values on us. But what I do know is that they're not listening to their users, who by and large seem to oppose this, or at least would rather have some sort of filter that lets them make the decisions. They're not listening to the European governments, which have put pressure on them to, you know, to at the very, you know, the bare minimum, allow these things in Europe, where breasts are simply not seen as the sexual objects that they are in the United States. And yeah, so I think that I think you might be onto something here.
Yeah. So it also, I feel like, you know, it's difficult to get into his mind, but to bring it back to where we started as we wrap up here, like, if Silicon Valley's conception of freedom was libertarian and principled in that way, which libertarianism is a fantasy, so it's kind of hard to be principled in that way. It's like saying I'm a principled Harry Potter fan, but like, I mean, they putting the more power in the hands of users to determine what content that they access should be within the ideal, but really it's just authoritarian. They want control over these things, and that's why even in the midst of these immense pressure on Facebook, with these congressional hearings about, you know, right-wing influence, where Zuckerberg had to come in front of Congress, they were so steadfast in resisting that, because it's about control. I mean, it is capitalism, and they're not any different in terms of their motivations.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely about control. I think that in the U.S. at least, although I'm not going to give a big pass to all other countries, but I think particularly in the U.S., both parties seem to be about controlling and shaping society in their own image. And that's what really concerns me here, is that, you know, the companies are doing the exact same thing. This is absolutely Zuckerberg's image. Twitter's, you know, maybe Jack Dorsey or whoever, I don't know, there's so many people who founded that company, but it's their image. And those are different images, but they're nevertheless not, it's not putting power in the hands of users. And so I would love to see these companies change, but I would also love to see new ideas for platforms, radical ideas for platforms come about that, you know, that are platforms that are controlled more by us. And it's hard sometimes to see what that looks like, but thankfully there are lots of really cool people who are working on that.
Yes. Well, Gillian C. York, author of Silicon Values, The Future of Free Speech Under Surveillance Capitalism, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Emma.
Of course. All right. With that said, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program. But first, Matt, what is happening on Left Reckoning?
Yeah, people will want to go check out your appearance on Left Reckoning if they haven't yet. The first half was very fun, but I think the interesting stuff was in the post game. I don't know how much I want to tease that, but just check it out. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning, where we go on record about certain things.
And this is not a mistake. We are supposed to be on camera. I'm not going to end Matt's promo early this week.
No.
No, although you did cut me off earlier before, but it's fine. It's fine, Bradley.
I cut you
off. It's fine. Yeah. Going into
the that's
break.
My job.
Oh, Matt. No. Internet censor.
No. Wait, who cut you off?
I don't know.
Oh.
I just got cut off earlier before the break.
Oh, because I thought we were cutting to the break, but you had an ad, because I'm not used to having ads on Thursday.
Me neither. Yeah, neither. But you know, whatever, we go with the flow. Yes, that was really fun, and I definitely think people will want to check out that post game for sure. So become a patron for Left Reckoning. With that said, we'll get to Binder and Brandon in the fun half.
We have some fun University of Austin stuff. Oh, yeah. So people are going to want to follow us into the fun.
And we'll do some Alex Jones stuff too, and yeah, we didn't get to any clips yesterday because Sam went for an hour and 45 minutes with the libertarian guy.
Yeah, with honestly too polished for libertarian. Like, we need more like Daryl Perry's, where there's like, you know, a bit of a live wire. This guy was too polished. And also, we should just say because people might not have noticed this on Twitter, but you know how that debate ended yesterday with Sam getting the Libertarian to agree to 90% tax rates?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, yes, we agree. I agree on that. Look, we found agreement, which he did was doing throughout the entire debate. He said now, after being called out on that, that he was lying or being facetious, which was not apparent at all in the clip.
No.
And I just think, like, look, you might be part of the Forward Party. You might be Libertarian. You're just like another politician, buddy. I'm sorry.
That was clarifying when he said that he'd been endorsed by the Forward Party immediately.
Yeah, like that. I mean, I gotta say,
Yang's a Libertarian.
If I was a Libertarian, I'd be worried about that sort of thing. I'd be really worried about the dilution of the brand. What sort of principles were thrown overboard for a guy like Andrew Yang? Is that a Libertarian? I would be worried about it if a DSA candidate was also a Forward Party candidate. But, yeah. You know, that's just me.
All right. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Yo.
What is up, everyone? Nomi Keen.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this... Sipping aid?
Yes.
Yes.
Is it me? It is you. Is it me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go throw up.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.